and this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. President Joe Biden scored a major legislative victory recently with the passage of his bipartisan infrastructure bill, but his approval ratings are dropping. Meanwhile, more people in former President Donald Trump's orbit, subpoenaed by the Congressional Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection. We want to hear from you. Your thoughts on President Biden's performance so far, the investigation into the 1-6 insurrection, and other national issues. And that's because today we are joined for the full hour by the political junkie, Ken Rudin. Ken, welcome back to Cincinnati Edition.
Thank you, Michael Monks.
And I'm so happy to say we also have with us today WVXU senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson. Hi, Howard.
It was great to be back.
Indeed it is. And for the first time, we have Miami University Associate Professor of Political Science, Dr. Anne Whitesell. Anne, so glad you could be with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And if you're listening and you want to join in our conversation at any time this hour, give us a call, 513-419-7100, or email talk at wvxu.org. As always, though, we start with Ken Rudin's political junkie trivia question. Ken, what is the question this month?
Well, Michael, first of all, happy Thanksgiving to you and everybody else. Pat Leahy, the Democratic senator from Vermont, last week announced he's retiring. He's 81 years old. He was first elected in 1974 when Gerald Ford was president. He announced he won't run again in 2022. He has already served 47 years in the Senate and counting. My trivia question is, who is the longest serving member of Congress in the history of Ohio? And by what I mean by that is you can combine House and Senate, if you like. The longest serving member of Congress in the history of Ohio.
The longest serving member of Congress in the history of Ohio. So an Ohio Congress member who has served for the longest.
And you could add Senate and House tenure together.
Yes. Okay, so let's figure that out. Who is it? If you know the answer, call 513-419-7100. Ken, tell our audience what they'll win.
They win a tour of Howard's apartment, which is pretty amazing.
It is a lovely apartment. I see it on our Zoom meetings every morning.
You win a political junkie button that's going gangbusters on eBay.
Indeed. Always going gangbusters. Again, 513-419-7100 is the number to call to answer that question or to weigh in on any of the topics you hear us discuss this hour. And speaking of topics, I think I'm going to start with something extraordinarily controversial here, and I want to hear from all three of you on this, so forgive me if it's too heavy to start the hour with, but my mother is starting Thanksgiving dinner at 3 p.m., and I think that's just a very weird time to do that. So, Ken, I want to know right off the gate, what is the appropriate hour to start Thanksgiving dinner?
Well, I'm seeing your mother at 3 o'clock, so that's good.
Oh, my gosh.
I think 4 o'clock is good. I've been preparing. I don't know if everybody has this, but I have this can of Ocean Spray cranberry sauce that is unbelievable. And when you open it, you have the ridges around it. It's incredible.
Indeed.
So that's what makes Thanksgiving to me.
All right.
Me.
Dr. Whitesell, in all of your scholarly research, have you found the appropriate hour to start Thanksgiving dinner?
Right. I think statistically, it has to be early enough so that you can have turkey sandwiches later in the evening. So I'd say 2 p.m.
All right. Howard?
Yeah. Our family, which gathers up in the Dayton area, is going to do it at 1 p.m.
That's lunch. That's Thanksgiving lunch, Howard.
No. Not if you don't eat breakfast.
That's Labor Day.
No. And Ann is exactly right. It leaves you plenty of room to start weighing into the leftovers later in the day.
Very interesting perspectives on how we all celebrate this wonderful holiday. In all honesty, very grateful for this holiday season and to be able to gather with family a little bit more than we did last year. And more than anything, grateful to be hosting this show with all of you fine people today. So let's get down to business. Ken, right off the bat, let's talk about President Biden, because the honeymoon is certainly over 9 months in, 10 months in to his presidency. And the poll numbers are pretty low at this point. I've seen some major polls that have him in the 30s. The 538 average has him at about 42% approval, about 52% disapproval. What's troubling Biden and his perception in the public?
Well, I think what's troubling everybody is the fact that when you wake up in the morning and you get in your car and you'll find that gas is at least a dollar more expensive than it was a year ago. You go to the store and you find that everything you want to eat and you know, purchase in a supermarket is far more expensive than it was a year ago, if not several years ago. I mean, I will point out historically, and this is a point worth mentioning, is that Ronald Reagan, you know, he of the 49 state landslide of 1984, in January of 1983, his approval ratings was 35%, which is lower than President Biden's 42%. They 35% for Reagan, and he won 49 states, where at the same time, the first George Bush had an 89% approval rating in 1991, and the next year he was defeated. So I still wouldn't worry about this that much because it could fluctuate, and they say that the prices will change next year. But having said that, having watched what happened to the Democrats in the 2021 off-year elections, having watched the prices go up, having watched the tumultuous exit from Afghanistan, all the things that seem to be going wrong, the fact that the coronavirus, the deaths and the infections are rising, as a lot of people thought it would, as the cold weather is coming. It's not good news for Biden, and it's being shown in the polls.
Dr. Whitesell, we'd like you to weigh in on this.
Yeah, I think, like Ken said, you know, I think a lot of it is about the rising prices that people are seeing at the pump, at the grocery store. I think people expect the president to do a lot, especially right after campaigning. They make a lot of promises, they always do, and then they can never live up to those promises. So people are always slightly disappointed in the president, and they don't really have anywhere else to turn that frustration to except the person that seems to be leading the country. I think the other thing to think about here is that because of how polarized our country is, I'm not sure how high we could realistically expect Biden's approval rating to get anyway. Probably 45% of the country is going to disapprove of his performance just because he's a Democrat. So there's not a lot of leeway for him to move up too far in the polls.
And Howard, when we think about prices at the pump, you know, that can impact people's perceptions of a president. But then you, I guess, depending on the party that's in power and the party that's out of power, you hear the same argument from the different perspectives. Oh, the president has no control over the price of gas. So is he being impacted by some things that are out of his control?
Yeah. And most presidents are at some point or another. I think Ann is absolutely correct that there is such polarization in the country right now that there's a ceiling, on his popularity. Now, the one thing he does have going for him is that his policy, some of his policies seem to be more popular than he is. The infrastructure bill and even Build Back Better to a certain extent. The polling shows that these are pretty popular ideas. Now he has to catch up with his policies. I know the infrastructure bill in Ohio, at least, was a very popular thing because people, are looking at it and seeing that there's possibility for real progress. And his numbers have to catch up, I think, with his policies.
513-419-7100 is the number to call if you would like to join our conversation and share your perspective on what you think is going on with the president, the way people are feeling about the presidency so far. What are your feelings about the presidency of Joe Biden 10 months into this new administration? I want to note that it appears the Democratic Party in Virginia asked for some research to be conducted, Ken, after that gubernatorial election that you referenced moments ago. They wanted to know why some voters in Northern Virginia and Richmond who voted for President Biden last year switched their votes to Republican Glenn Youngkin, who won that race, flipping that governor's mansion from blue to red just a few weeks ago. And one of the things that they found in this focus group that they conducted interviews with multiple focus groups, apparently, is, quote, "Our weak national brand left us vulnerable. Voters couldn't name anything that Democrats had done except a few who who said we passed the infrastructure bill. That bill didn't overcome their opinions that we have spent the last year infighting and careening from crisis to crisis. Is that a fair analysis?
It's unfortunate, but it is fair. And I say it's unfortunate because it's very simplistic. I mean, the fact is, talking about infrastructure bill does not work on a bumper sticker. But if you say parental control of schools or critical race theory, which is such a bogus issue to begin with, but people, the fact that we all know, that we've all heard of critical race theory, the fact that we've always heard of parental control of schools, that worked. As hard as Terry McAuliffe, the Democratic candidate, tried to tar Glenn Youngkin, the winner, with the Trump brush, the fact or the anti-abortion brush, Virginia was also always thought to be a leaning blue, if not just a purple state. But the fact is, those Republican slogans worked, that they were effective. Youngkin is a smoother candidate. McAuliffe represents the old school. I mean, he was a governor once before, 8 years ago, and he was a popular governor at the time, but he was old politics. Glenn Youngkin was a new face. And the fact is, with the inflation, with Afghanistan, with an increased corona cases, Youngkin and the Republicans did very well. I think even more of a shock was with New Jersey, which was not supposed to be close at all. Look, everybody said Virginia was going to be close, and it was. But New Jersey, which was close, it wasn't even supposed to be close at all. Phil Murphy, their Democratic governor, was supposed to win in a landslide, and we didn't know until 3 or 4 days later that they're Democratic one. And I think that's part of one, the Democrats are not selling their plan, the infrastructure plan. As I say, it doesn't work on a bumper sticker. Biden is not really explaining it well. And two, the Republican just said, well, you know, everything stinks, everything's expensive, try our brand. You know, it's amazing. For people who so were desperate to get rid of the Republicans in the 2020 election, and they found that after 10 months, oh my God, after 10 months, things are not better. It's time to try the Republicans again.
To build upon what Ken said, further findings from this consulting firm that did some focus group research following the outcome of the Democrats' loss in Virginia. They conducted focus groups among suburban Northern Virginia and Richmond voters who voted in 2020 for Democrat Joe Biden to be president, but voted in 2021, just a few weeks ago, for Republican Glenn Youngkin to be governor of Virginia. We are joined today by Miami University Associate Professor of Political Science, Dr. Ann Weitzel. And Ann, I want to ask, this is something that they found, is that the Youngkin equals Trump hits did not work very well. They write, quote, "We're not saying this was a mistake or that Democrat Terry McAuliffe had a better message he left on the table. We don't know, but we do know that if our most effective message in 2022 is that Republicans equal Trump, we're going to get creamed." So has that ship sailed as it relates to messaging, Anne?
Well, I think it definitely depends on the candidate. I mean, Youngkin was very different from some of the other Republicans that really tried to mold themselves in the model of Trump. He wanted to appeal to the MAGA base, but also made himself seem much more moderate, and therefore, people were not convinced when McAuliffe was talking about, like, okay, if you vote for Youngkin, we're getting essentially Trump in Virginia. And so I think the fact that Youngkin didn't have any previous government experience that you could turn to and say, look, here's what he's done in office before, that he, again, didn't seem to be fully embracing Trump, right? Trump never went to Virginia and campaigned with him. I think for those Republican candidates, they would probably fare differently. I'm not sure better or worse, probably depends on where exactly they're campaigning, than those who really seem to hold on to Trump's rhetoric and embrace Trump and, really want to kind of take up his mantle.
Another one of the findings, Howard, from this is that these focus groups, according to the research that was offered, say that President Biden is not being blamed by these voters for the Delta variant, which caused severe and deadly spikes in COVID-19. Inflation, they're not blaming them for. They're not even blaming them for supply chain bottlenecks the way some right-wing media are trying to. But this report goes on to say, quote, "But at the same time, these 2020 Biden voters had little positive to say about him right now, and many describe disappointment or a sense that he is not doing well. They were reluctant to say he's not up to the job, but they don't feel like he's getting it done right now." Why do you think that is, Howard?
Well, I think because they haven't really sold their message. And I think one thing you're going to see now, and there was a lot of coverage of this yesterday, that the Biden administration and the leadership, Democratic leadership in Congress, are going to go out all over the country. Every member is expected to do 5 events touting infrastructure and Build Back Better between now and the end of the year. Biden himself is going to be traveling around to states where there are critical Senate race is coming up in 2022. And Democratic supporting super PACs are spending millions and millions of dollars in advertising to tout their message. And they're not running away from their message like Democrats have sometimes done in the past. Back in the Obama administration, it was kind of hard to find Democratic congressional candidates who would absolutely embrace the Obama health care plan, and the economic stimulus and that sort of thing. And it cost them in the midterm election. I think that they're finally waking up to the fact that they have to go out and sell themselves and sell their plans to voters in key states if they're going to have any chance whatsoever in 2022 to hold on to majorities in Congress.
We're going to talk about how this infrastructure bill may be able to do that on the other side of the break. But first, we have to check in with this trivia question. Ken, remind us what this month's Political Junkie trivia question is.
Who is the longest serving member of Congress in the history of Ohio? And again, when I say Congress, you can combine House and Senate.
All right, let's go to the phone lines now. We have Jeff on the line. Jeff, you want to try and answer?
Sure, I'll go with Robert Crosser out of Cleveland.
Ken, is it Robert Crawford out of Cleveland?
Robert Crosser, is that what he's talking about? Well, actually, Robert Crosser is very close. I can't believe he remembers Robert Crosser.
Yeah.
But Robert Crosser served he served 37 years and 305 days. That's close to the record, but not yet there.
Ooh, Jeff, great
Robert
guess.
Crosser, what
not
a great
quite correct.
Guess.
Wow. Yeah, well done, Jeff.
Very good guess. Yeah.
Think about it a little more. Maybe give us another call. Let's check in and see if someone else has the answer, though. Mary Jane is up next. Hi, Mary Jane. What's your answer?
Hi. Howard Metzenbaum.
Ooh, Ken, is it Howard Metzenbaum?
Well, Howard Metzenbaum served about 19 years in the Senate. You know, he was appointed, then he lost to Glenn, then he won again, if I guess, 2 or 3 terms. But he served about 19 years in Congress altogether, all 19 in the Senate. So that's certainly about half of what Robert Crosser had. Metzenbaum was not the right answer.
Another good guess, Mary Jane. Give it some more thought, maybe call us back. We'll check in now with Steve. Hi, Steve. Did you have an answer to the question?
Yeah, my answer was just taken, so I don't have the right answer.
Oh, Steve, I'm sorry.
I do want to make a quick comment.
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
That in terms of the infrastructure bill, if our electors don't get with it and put the internet as part of infrastructure, China is going to stomp on us.
All right, Steve, thank you so much for sharing that perspective.
Although broadband expansion is part of that bill. Broadband expansion is part of that infrastructure bill.
Well, we will talk about the messaging on that and how Democrats might be able to use it, how Republicans might be able to use it. This is the Political Junkie on Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.
Support comes from Pixel and Timber, a lean product development firm that takes inventions from idea to reality. Pixel and Timber works with innovative companies, individuals, and medical professionals in the tri-state to transform their product ideas into functional prototypes, manufactured products, and licensable technologies. You can learn more at pixelandtimber.com.
Hi, it's Audie Cornish, and Thanksgiving is a time to reflect on what really matters, not just what you're going to eat on the big day. We take a step back, express gratitude, and gather together in person or in spirit. For 50 years, NPR has brought you the stories and voices that matter, powerful public figures, and your own neighbors. Celebrate Thanksgiving, the many voices of the American experience, and NPR 50.
On 91.7 WVXU.
Support comes from UC's College of Law's Schwartz Lecture, presenting the accidental origins and haphazard construction of tort. Stanford Law professor Nora Engstrom discusses the question, if not some meta theory, what does explain tort law as it currently exists? Tuesday, November 30th via Zoom. Registration at law.uc.edu/Schwartz Lecture.
Support comes from Robin Wood Flowers, a local family-owned business focused on offering unique and elegant floral designs for over 20 years. From corporate gifting and parties to decorating your holiday table, you can celebrate the special people in your life with an arrangement from Robin Wood Flowers. More online at robinwoodflowers.com. Support for Cincinnati Edition comes from the Johnson Foundation, a private grant-making foundation committed to creating a more vibrant urban core through community development and civic engagement. More information at johnson-foundation.org.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue with our full hour of national politics, and we are joined for this full hour by the political junkie Ken Rudin, and WVXU senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson, and Miami University associate professor of political science, Dr. Anne Whitesell. Our trivia question again, Ken, one more time. Help us out here.
The longest serving member of in Congress from Ohio in history.
All right, let's see if we've got someone with the correct answer now. Dave is on the line. Hi, Dave, what's your answer to the trivia question?
I'm going to guess Marcy Kaptur, 38 years.
Ken, is it Marcy Kaptur?
Marcy Kaptur is the correct answer.
Oh, how about that?
The applause seemed kind of weak this week, but maybe there's too much stuff, and maybe they went to Ann's house at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. But here's
Very good.
She's served 38 years, 325 days. The record by a woman is Barbara Mikulski, 40 years. And so if Marcy Kaptur gets reelected in 2022, she will break the record for the longest serving woman in congressional history.
And Ken, the Republicans in the legislature have drawn a congressional district map that is going to try to knock her off.
Really? Do Republicans do that with redistricting? I didn't realize they do that.
We'll be talking more about gerrymandering a little bit later in the hour. But first, let me tell Dave, congratulations on the correct answer. You will have some bragging rights at your Thanksgiving table tomorrow. So I'm going to place you on hold. Stay there. Our producer, Selena Reeder, is going to get some information from you, and then we'll get that political junkie, which is going like gangbusters on eBay, as Ken always says. That'll be in the mail to you very soon. Dave, thanks for listening. Thanks for calling, and congratulations.
Thank you.
All right. 513-419-7100 is still the number to call, even if you missed out on trivia, if you want to weigh in and share some perspective with us or ask some questions of our panelists today. We've got an email from Ed who writes, how is the infrastructure bill being paid for without adding significant amounts to the already enormous national debt? And I'm going to pose this question to Dr. Anne Whitesell from Miami University, not because I know whether you have an answer to this question, but because it's written by a man named Ed Whitesell who says, yes, I am Dr. Whitesell's dad.
Yes. I think both my parents are listening. So hi, mom and dad.
And he also wants to know if you brought your sweater today because it's pretty cold outside.
Well, he knows I'm with my in-laws actually right now. How's it being paid for? So one of the things to remember about this, and I think is being lost in the discussion of the infrastructure bill, is that it's paid for over 10 years. So we often hear about the multi-trillion dollar deal, but that's over 10 years. So it's only $175 billion a year. Some of that is kind of all already allocated spending that's just being reconfigured. And some of that is going to be taxes raised on the wealthiest Americans. The Joint Committee on Taxation actually just came out yesterday and said that they had made a mistake. And while they initially thought that it would lower taxes on millionaires, it's actually going to be raising taxes on millionaires. So there'll be some money raised from that. And then there's some provisions of the bill, depending on what's in the final bill, that may bring in more or less revenue, provisions like controlling drug prices when it comes to Medicare and things like that. So, but the Democrats have said that it will all be paid for.
Well, I imagine you'll have to address this further with Ed come the holidays. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, good luck with that. but Ken, this is, you know, money bills are complicated to understand. What it's going to take with a bill like this is what it's promising to come to fruition, and that's going to take some time, right? I mean, even here in our area, we've been looking at a Brent Spence Bridge project over the course of three different presidencies now, and it looks like this infrastructure bill might be the answer to that project. We don't know for sure yet. We don't even know what it might look like. But until shovels go into the ground, do you think people will be wondering what this bill is?
No, I agree with you completely. I agree that I think that until it takes effect and we start to see the results, Americans won't know the difference, won't feel anything by this at all. But what bugs me the most about this, and this is what I really, my sense of what politics is like today, these days, is that the only 13 Republicans in the House support it, whereas 17 Republicans in the Senate support it, including Rob Portman. But of the 13 Republicans who voted for it in the House, they're getting death threats. They're getting death threats for voting for an infrastructure bill. This is what just eats me alive, that the toxicity of politics in this country is so severe, so great, that if you vote for a nominally a non-political thing like an infrastructure bill, you get threats against your life, against your family's life and your pet's life. I mean, this is what's happened to politics, and this is what just drives me crazy.
And Howard, this is something we talked about on a previous show, because you wrote a column about how local members of Congress voted against this piece of legislation. Senator McConnell from Kentucky and Senators Portman and Brown from Ohio supported it. But Senator Paul in Kentucky did not, and none of the local members of the U.S. House, all Republicans, supported it. And so will there possibly be some penalty for them down the road if this proves to be successful?
Well, no. And the reason is because of the redistricting situation. You know, right now, you know, in Steve Chabot's case, one of the House members who voted against this thing, the present map that was signed into law by Governor DeWine, and it's going to be challenged in court, obviously, in the Ohio Supreme Court, but it makes it easier for him to get reelected because it adds a very heavily Republican county to his district, or it keeps that county, Warren County, in his district. You know, the thing is, it's there's no price to be paid, it seems. And Ken's absolutely right that there's, you know, the toxicity of the political system right now is just insane. I mean, this is something that whether you approve of the spending or not, you can see that there are benefits of it. And there are a whole lot of people in this region. You talk about the Brent Spence Bridge. A lot of people want to see that happen. And they've wanted to see it happen for a quarter of a century, and now they have a possibility of doing it. But none of the Republicans locally dared to vote for it. And I think they were following the lead of Donald Trump, who was lobbying Mitch McConnell to oppose it. And Mitch McConnell did not.
And it's strange because we heard a lot about the term Infrastructure Week, and it became a bit of a running gag during the presidency of Donald Trump because we never saw any actual Infrastructure Week take place. If this bill, Howard, had been presented by a Republican majority during a Republican presidency, even in its current form, do you think it would have won their support?
Probably, but it wouldn't have been.
I kind of think that's what's eating up Trump the most, is because one of the first things he promised when he was elected, we'd have a new infrastructure bill. He talked about it, and nothing ever happened. Biden did it within 10 months, and Trump went ballistic and said, you got to vote against it.
And Ken, Trump came to this city and stood on the banks of the Ohio River and pointed over to that bridge and said, we're going to fix this.
And so did Barack Obama.
Yeah, and so did Barack Obama. But nothing was ever done until Biden came in, and it didn't take him very long with the Democratic leadership in Congress and people like Rob Portman, who helped negotiate the deal for this infrastructure bill. That's what made it happen.
I want to read a quick email that we got from Benjamin. He writes, quote, we saw a similar bizarre strategy. I'm sorry, this is about Trump and the Virginia election. He says, we saw a similar bizarre strategy by Democrats in Kentucky with McConnell versus McGrath. That's Amy McGrath, the Democrat who ran against Mitch McConnell last year. Simply revolving election messaging around Trump is not enough for secondary figures. A large portion of the population is okay with Trumpism, but not with how Trumpy Trump was with it. If others are less Trumpy in presentation, the messages still resonate and motivate that voting block. Dr. Whitesell, this might be something that's understood by Republican senators like Mitch McConnell and Rob Portman, but doesn't seem to play in the House, because a lot of the Republican members of the House who get a lot of media attention are quite, quote, Trumpy, I would say. And so we've spent some time in the media class talking about infighting among Democrats, progressives versus moderates, and Kristen Sinema, Joe Manchin, AOC, and the rest. Is it unfair not to explore that same dynamic among the Republican side of the aisle?
Well, I think one thing to think about here is we're comparing people who are running for a statewide office versus people who are running in certain districts. And this kind of gets back to what Howard is saying about the importance of gerrymandering. If you're running for statewide office, you know, unless you're in like a very conservative state, you're still going to need to appeal to some independents or some more moderate people within your own party. And so, you know, McConnell, again, Glenn Youngkin, you know, they're mindful of that to be very, you know, quote unquote, Trumpy would be to turn off potentially some moderate Republicans, some independents. But if you're in such a gerrymandered district where you're in a safe seat, it's not competitive, then what you're really fighting for is winning the primary election. And then you need to be more conservative, more Trumpy. And so I think, I mean, we see the same thing with Democrats, but in the reverse, right? When you're competing in primaries versus general elections, but just in general, when you're trying to win over a statewide electorate, you have to appeal slightly broader because typically the population is more heterogeneous.
But look what's happening in the Republican Senate primary in Ohio.
Yep.
These Republican candidates can't be pro-Trump enough. They're attacking the other for not being sufficiently pro-Trump. So there seems to be no concern, no caring at all about what moderate, what never Trump Republicans may be thinking. They're going all out for Trump.
But the thing about that, Ken, is that five of the six Republican candidates for the Senate seat, Rob Portman's seat, as a matter of fact, are trying to out-Trump each other, just tripping over themselves to show their, you know, their loyalty and their fealty to Donald Trump forever and ever. I don't think that's a great strategy in a Republican primary in this state, but I don't think it's a very good strategy in a general election in this state for the reasons that Ann was talking about. I think it's going to backfire on them.
And that will depend heavily on who the Democratic nominee is, I imagine.
Sure.
Howard.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what the climate might be.
Tim Ryan,
the Democratic congressman from Northeastern Ohio.
Yes.
Yeah.
513-419-7100 is the number to call to join our conversation. But speaking of redistricting, all the states are going through this process right now. States do handle this differently with some similarities, of course, but maybe there's nonpartisan commissions. Maybe it's the state legislature. There's always hurt feelings about how these districts get drawn because there's questions about whether they are done fairly. We are seeing some serious concerns being raised in Ohio currently about the way congressional districts are being drawn. Hamilton County, where Cincinnati is, of course, is now to be part of three different congressional districts should this current map approved by the legislature and signed by Governor Mike DeWine survive any court challenges that may come down the line. I read in the Washington Post this week that competitive House districts across the country are being wiped off the map. In Ohio, we're seeing Republicans do this, but we're seeing Democrats do this in states that they control as well. And I'll go to you, Dr. Whitesell, on this, Associate Professor of Political Science at Miami University. What are the long-term challenges to democracy, to our Republican Democratic style of governance, if this is the way we carve out who's voting for whom?
Right. It's what it comes down to is more the elected officials picking their voters and the voters picking the elected officials. And some of this is sorting based on, you know, the voters sort themselves, right? They move to places where people think like them and are like them. But the less competitive the districts are, I would expect the more disengagement we're going to see with the process, right? Because why would you bother participating or even fighting to win an election where there is no chance, right? You become an uncompetitive district, and then you may eventually have uncontested elections. You could essentially see this devolving into kind of a one-party state in some areas or some parts of the country where they're just so gerrymandered that one party or the other just doesn't even bother really running. We're doing research right now with another professor at Miami University, another professor at Wright State. We're looking at local parties. And what we find is that a lot of the local county parties in non-competitive areas basically are non-existent because there's no reason to even exist as a party in those places. There's no competition. No one wants to run for office. And so I think potentially you have more widespread phenomenon like that.
We are seeing, according to analysis from the Washington Post, there are 15 states so far that have new congressional district maps as of Monday of this week. And the Post reports, quote, the number of districts where the 2020 presidential margin was within 5 percentage points has fallen from 23 to just 10. And they say that the new maps in those states have already netted a double-digit increase in solidly Republican seats compared with previous maps there. Now, Ken, we know that the U.S. Census and the count of the American population determines how many congressional representatives each state has. Ohio lost one due to population. Texas gained. And a lot of Texas's population growth was credited to Hispanic people who have moved there, but we aren't seeing the new districts designed in that state reflect that. So,
oh my God,
this is a big challenge as well.
Not even close. I mean, Texas currently they have 23 Republicans and 13 Democrats, and they gained 2 congressional districts. And as you say, Michael, they are most of the population increases in Texas is due to increased Latino population. Yet with the Republican legislature, people forget how important state legislatures are. Redistricting is a perfect example. But with a Republican state legislature and a Republican governor, they will draw at those 2 new seats will be Republican districts. And the way they've redrawn the maps, there were 12 close elections, relatively close elections in the 2020 congressional district races. There is now, they've redrawn the map to now those 12 now is down to 1 competitive district. I mean, out of 40 seats in Texas, maybe one is going to be competitive. Even Ohio, I mean, it's not it's a fairly broken down even state, and yet there's 12 Democrat or 12 Republicans, four Democrats, it's the way they draw it does not reflect the state population at all. That's why, as I say, state legislatures and the governorships are so crucial.
We will pick this up in just a moment. Howard, I think you've got a thought. We'll get to that if you can hang on to that.
Sure.
When we come back on the other side of this, we also want to talk about the 1-6 committee in the U.S. Congress and some of the new subpoenas that have come out. Stay tuned for that. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.
Support comes from The Flying Locksmiths, specializing in commercial doors and hardware since 1946, featuring door hardware repairs, hinge repairs, even commercial door and frame replacements. The Flying Locksmiths can also secure existing metal, glass, and wood commercial doors. TheFlyingLocksmiths.com. If it's on the door, they handle it.
Support comes from Everything But The House. You can find or sell everything uncommon in this curated and carefully authenticated online marketplace for secondhand goods, including jewelry, art, antiques, collectibles, and more. As featured on HGTV, you can shop thousands of items and learn more about estate and consignment solutions at ebth.com.
When you get up in the morning, you turn to WVXU to begin the day in the know. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. I'll be here to fill you in on the local news, weather, and traffic, in addition to the in-depth perspective you'll receive from NPR's Morning Edition. You'll start your day ahead of the crowd. Join me at 91.7 WVXU, connecting you to a world of ideas.
Support comes from Cincinnati Playhouse in the Park's production of A Christmas Carol. The holiday family tradition is back, presented by First Financial Bank. A Christmas Carol, November 24th through December 30th. Mark's Theater Season, presented by Schuller Group. Tickets and COVID safety information at cincyplay.com. Support comes from the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra, presenting Debussy, Ravel, and Mendelssohn November 26th and 27th at Music Hall. Conductor Roderick Cox makes his CSO debut alongside pianist Conrad Tau, presenting works that use the full palette of orchestral colors to capture the sounds of imagination. Tickets at cincinnatisymphony.org. Season sponsor Western and Southern.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We're set now to wrap up our full hour on national politics with the political junkie Ken Rudin, WVXU senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson, and Miami University associate professor of political science, Dr. Ann Whitesell. Howard, I believe you had a thought. I interrupted.
Just a quick follow-up on what Ken was saying about Ohio. Ohio, the situation right now, since 2011 has been 16 congressional districts. Four of them belong to Democrats, 12 of them belong to Republicans. This new map that the Republicans jammed through the legislature last week had absolutely no support whatsoever from Democrats, which it's required to do under the Ohio Constitution now. And would make a situation where of the 15, 13 of these congressional districts would likely go to Republicans. And that's about 80%. And as Ken pointed out, the vote in congressional races over the last decade in Ohio has been about 54% Republican, 46% Democrat. But they're going to end up, if this stands in court, and I'm not sure it will, with 80% of the congressional seats in Ohio.
I want to read a couple of emails from listeners. Steve writes in to say, we don't hear any discussion of the climate crisis by Republicans. Why are Republicans so reticent to discuss and or even suggest government action to combat the climate crisis? And Kevin writes, quote, referring to the hateful and dangerous political climate and its toxicity is a subtle form of normalization. To be clear, the death threats, the murderous cartoons and depictions, the calls for violence in the name of freedom are coming from one side. Calling the atmosphere toxic is accurate, but there's a very clear source of the venom. Failing to identify that source is another form of the both sides are the same trope. They are not. Thank you for listening, and thank you for sharing your perspective via email, talk@wvxu.org. You can also call 513-419-7100. We'll go to Jeff, who's on the line now. Hi, Jeff. What's your question or comment?
Hi. Yeah, you were discussing redistrict maps earlier, and of course, the Republicans are trying to draw themselves very safe map districts, but in the past year, I've heard that there's been a trend of a bunch of people moving into Ohio, places like California and Colorado. And I just wonder what the panel thinks the effect of that might be. Might that surprise Republicans in upcoming elections?
If people are moving into other states?
No. People are moving into Ohio,
gotcha,
coming from Colorado, California, places like that, and might that make those...
Oh, I see. So maybe the districts that are designed to be Republican-leaning could be a surprise for the Republicans, what you're saying.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking.
Oh, right. Yeah. I guess this might be a possibility, Dr. Whitesell, right? We would have to know the demographics. And Jeff, I'm going to hang up. Thank you so much for the call. We do appreciate the question very much. You know, we're talking about Republican districts and Democratic districts, but these are districts where people will cast ballots. So nothing is for certain for always.
Right. And I think, I mean, some of this is where people move to, right? So if you have people moving from California into Cincinnati or to Cleveland, then it's probably not going to change the political landscape that much. But yeah, certainly, you know, as people move around, and even as, you know, Ohio's population diversifies, that's going to change, you know, how the party breakdown, it was decided within districts. And I mean, that's part of why state legislators redraw the districts every 10 years is so they can, you know, adjust for those trends. So
I was just in California last week for a vacation. I stayed in Palm Springs and Los Angeles. It is obviously a deep blue state politically. But while I was in downtown Los Angeles, where I had a hotel room right next to Pershing Square, their downtown center, there was a protest of people who were against vaccinations. There were people reminding how much they don't like Governor Gavin Newsom. There were people there against vax mandates. There were people who had signs, "I support In-N-Out Burger." I mean, this is how meta these protests have gotten, I suppose, and how very specific. So even in pockets of liberal states, there are conservative or right-wing people who will cast ballots as well. So I guess on the flip side of that coin, that's what it looks like. And we got that email moments ago that talked about normalizing both sides. And Ken, I want to touch on this, and then I want to touch overall on political sentiments as we head into Thanksgiving. Very controversial.
By the way, one more thing, quick thing, that talking about people moving into Ohio, you know that I am moving. When they give me the post, the job as hosting Cincinnati Edition, I'm moving. You know that. So I'm going to be moving in. I probably live in Covington, but I'll probably be moving in to take that job. Thanks so much. And thanks to all the listeners who demanded that happening.
Well, you made the mistake of listing me as a reference. And so I can assure you that that is not happening for you, Ken. Mm. I'm afraid to say that conversation did not go well. But, you know, are we normalizing things like the January 6th insurrection, Ken? Because that was not that long ago. And it doesn't seem that we are highly focused on that. We've got subpoenas issued by that committee in Congress to investigate this thing. Some Trump associates, Steve Bannon, you know, are being called to testify. As some people want to get to the bottom of it. But my goodness, it seems that a lot of people, particularly Republican members of the Congress, are ready to forget that happened.
No, I first of all, I really appreciated Kevin's email because I agree with him completely. This is, I mean, for us to not say Republican, Republican, Republican is not to dismiss the fact what the Republicans are doing. I think I just don't think we need to beat everybody over the head, but we should never forget The fact that violence is increasing, the fact that they're stealing, the Republican state legislatures are taking away the power of determining the fairness of elections and putting them in partisan hands. The fact that most Republicans, except for Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, I mean, it seems like every Republican looks at January 6th and say it's no big deal. And the fact that the American people look like they're ready to vote for Republican Congress in 2022, despite this fact, is just startling. So yes, the January 6th committee is going to call for the subpoenas and the testimony of Roger Stone and Steve Bannon and everybody else. But But the Republican Party, for the most part, they are looking at this as saying like it's just a walk in the park, a day in the park. And this is what the most frightening thing of all, and exactly what Kevin says, that if we're suddenly normalizing this violence and this hatred, I just fear what happens after 2022.
Well, I've got about 90 seconds left.
I'm sorry.
I appreciate it. I asked you the question. I wanted to hear your answer in full. And in our last 90 seconds, you know, to go back to how we started our conversation was about Thanksgiving. And this is a period designed to express gratitude and be with family. But we know that politics has divided even households. I want to give the three of you an opportunity here on the last bit of this program today. I'll start with you, Dr. Whitesell, since your parents are listening. What's a topic that you will discuss at the Thanksgiving table that is not politics?
Oh, man, everything is political. But, my dogs.
All right, we'll talk about the dogs. Do your parents call them grand dogs?
Yeah.
Oh, goodness. All right, Howard, what are you going to talk about that is not politics?
Well, I've laid the law down to my nephews and others that we are not going to talk about politics. We'll talk about sports.
Sports. All right. And Ken, what type of...
There was a new baby in my extended family. She's less than 2 years old. She is the light of everybody's eye. We can't keep our eyes off her, and we'll be talking about it throughout the entire meal. That starts at 4 o'clock.
Okay, but
she's a cutie,
but how did this baby vote in 2020?
She actually, I can't think of a funny answer. Sorry.
Well, how about this? How about a happy Thanksgiving to all three of you? I know that talking politics is very challenging these days. It really is, because there are serious issues and there are pieces of legislation that could impact your lives in positive or negative ways that, it's difficult to talk about because of the political divide that seems so simple in the way people feel about them. And if you don't subscribe to Ken Rudin's Political Junkie email, you should, because he does have a message about this in the most recent one that went out, hoping for the best and fearing the worst. It's definitely worth a read. So you can follow him on social media and check out that email list if you go to his website and subscribe to that. So Howard Wilkinson, Ken Rudin, Dr. Ann Whitesell, happy Thanksgiving to all of you, and thanks for the hour you spent with us today.
And to you too, Michael, and to all the listeners.
Yes.
Yes. Happy Thanksgiving.
And to Ann's father.
Happy Thanksgiving, Ed. And happy Thanksgiving to all of you who spent this hour listening and calling in and sending this email. We really do appreciate it. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our assistant producer is Nick Swartzel. Our engineer today is Dave Schwermer. We'll talk to you again on Monday. Happy Thanksgiving.